content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the November 19th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing shows a football game. Joe Biden has the ball. He is diving over the goal line for a touchdown. He's got on a old school blue jersey and the old leather football helmets. And back behind him is Nancy Pelosi in the same kind of getup. Number 12, so it looks like maybe she's the quarterback, got her hands raised in a touchdown signal. A Republican football player in a red uniform and a modern helmet has Biden around the knees and making the tackle just as he goes across. The headline is Biden's Big Deal. Will the $1.2 trillion infrastructure plan make a real difference for America? That is our first main story. We'll start there. Biden gets infrastructure bill across the goal line. What happened? In a major victory for a beleaguered President Biden, the House passed the long-delayed $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill last week, providing what Biden called a once-in-a-generation investment in the nation's roads, bridges, ports, rails, and water systems. The vote was 228 to 206, with 13 moderate Republicans joining most Democrats to support the bill. The late-night passage came after long days of Capitol Hill wrangling that pitted moderate Democrats against progressives who insisted that an infrastructure vote wait until after the passage of the $1.8 trillion social spending bill act called Build Back Better. With Biden and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi deeply involved in negotiations, all but six holdout progressives agreed to vote for the infrastructure bill after moderates promised to support Build Back Better if an independent analysis of its budgetary impact matched up with White House projections. The infrastructure measure calls for more than $550 billion in new spending on a wide array of programs. They range from improving water infrastructure, $55 billion, and overhauling the electrical grid, $73 billion, to expanding broadband internet, $65 billion. The bill includes the biggest investments in Amtrak, $66 billion, and public transit, $39 billion in U.S. history, and $110 billion for replacing and repairing roads, tunnels, and bridges. It also includes major spending to combat climate change, including $7.5 billion to build a national network of electric vehicle charging stations, and $47 billion to help communities withstand floods, wildfires, and other impacts of global warming. Biden, who will sign the bill next week, called the measure a monumental step forward as a nation and said it would create millions of blue-collar jobs. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, one of 19 Republican senators who voted for the measure in August, called the bill a godsend for his home state of Kentucky. But the 13 House Republicans who voted yes were condemned as traitors by many Trump-aligned conservatives who called for them to be stripped of committee assignments. Those 13 Republicans, said Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, voted to pass Joe Biden's communist takeover of America. What the editorials said. This is a big win for Biden and a bigger win for America, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. The infrastructure bill promises a long-needed overhaul of the nation's distressed physical and technological landscape, which has become a global humiliation. The many Republicans and few Democrats who voted no should be endlessly reminded of their short-sightedness as the bill's many benefits become evident to the public. The historic bill's passage affirms what can be achieved by working together, said the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Americans owe a debt of gratitude to those Republicans who ignored threats from the far right and did what they saw as best for the country. Their crucial support is reminiscent of a less partisan time and is refreshing to see. More, please. What the columnist said. The 13 Republicans who voted to pass this monstrosity committed a grievous betrayal, said Philip Klein in NationalReview.com. They could have delivered a crushing blow to a flailing president. Instead, they tossed him a life raft and allowed to put bipartisan gloss on his radical agenda. Those facing re-election should be primaried and defeated. Those retiring should be shamed for the rest of their lives. Such vitriol speaks volume about the GOP's ideological character, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. When Trump was president, both he and many Republicans claimed to support infrastructure spending, and their endless promises to deliver an infrastructure week became comic fodder. The GOP's rejection of it now shows that refusing to share power with Democrats is their only guiding principle. Republicans will indulge kooks, open racists, and suspected criminals, but not the unforgivable sin of voting for a bill Trump wanted to be able to sign for himself. This act will transform America in the next 10 years, said Juliana Kaplan and Ben Wink in BusinessInsider.com. It will result in faster and smoother commutes, cleaner air and water, upgraded trains and buses, and faster internet service. Whether it will give Biden and the Democrats the boost they need to lift the sagging political fortunes is another matter, said Shannon Pettypiece in NBCNews.com. Americans are feeling battered by inflation, supply chain disruptions, and a lingering pandemic, which is why Biden's approval ratings have dropped into the low 40s. Much of the bill's impact won't become tangible to voters for years. Still, getting a bill across the finish line is a big freaking deal, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. A long string of presidents from both parties have made noises about fixing aging roads and crumbling bridges, and now Biden has delivered. It's a big win for him and the country at a moment when many were questioning whether divided Democrats had what it takes to get anything done. Whether that will restore voters' shaken faith in Biden and his party remains to be seen, but it's a critical start. The controversy of the week is Rittenhouse trial. Was he justified in killing two men? In a Kenosha, Wisconsin courtroom this week, it was baby-faced killer Kyle Rittenhouse who was trying to beat homicide charges, said Cynthia Miller Idris in MSNBC.com. But what was really on trial was citizen vigilantism. When Kenosha police last year shot a black man, Jacob Blake, seven times in the back, the resulting nights of angry protest inspired a right-wing paramilitary group to call for armed citizens to protect local businesses. Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old who dreamed of becoming a cop, answered the call and drove across state lines from his Illinois home armed with an AR-15 an older friend had bought for him. When Rittenhouse was confronted by several protesters, and when one tried to grab his gun and another swung a skateboard at him, he began firing, killing Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber, and grievously wounding a third. In testimony this week, a sobbing Rittenhouse claimed he was cornered by protesters, said L.Z. Granderson in the Los Angeles Times. I didn't do anything wrong. I defended myself, he said. But Rosenbaum and Huber would be alive today if Rittenhouse hadn't thought he had the right to grab a gun and take the law into his own hands. An acquittal will send a message that other armed citizens should also try to play hero. And in a nation with more guns than people, good luck getting that genie back into the bottle. The prosecution's case has fallen apart, said Robert Verbruggen in NationalReview.com. An abundance of smartphone video confirms Rittenhouse's claims that he only fired under duress, with people closing in on him and attacking. Indeed, the turning point of the trial may have been the admission by Gage Grossroots, the only one of the three men shot by Rittenhouse to survive, that he was pointing his own loaded handgun at Rittenhouse at the time of the shooting. And let's remember the context, said Rod Dreher in the AmericanConservative.com. Entire city blocks of Kenosha had just been incinerated, dozens of small businesses destroyed, and hundreds of cars set on fire. A 17-year-old should not have been out in a riot, however noble his intentions. But Kyle Rittenhouse is not the enemy of civilization. The people he shot were and are. Legally speaking, Rittenhouse's self-defense claims are solid, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. But that just shows how guns twist the logic of self-defense. The mere presence of his AR-15 let Rittenhouse claim that anyone confronting him could have taken his gun and that he was therefore in reasonable fear for his life. If jurors get past the absurdity of him being there armed in the first place, Rittenhouse will probably walk, said Mark Brown in Chicago Sun-Times. But let's not confuse that with a moral exoneration. Rittenhouse had absolutely no legitimate to be there that night. This foolish boy probably didn't imagine he'd kill two men, said Timothy Carney in WashingtonExaminer.com. But when you bring a loaded gun to a riot, there can be no happy ending. Many Americans are in no mood to heed that lesson, said Charles Homans in the New York Times. For all their differences, the two sides on the streets of Kenosha that night were united by a belief, shared by the mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, that our nation has descended into civil war and that the time for talking was over. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for spuds, with news from New Zealand of a recently unearthed potato weighing an astounding 17.2 pounds. Gardeners Donna and Colin Craig Brown say that as they wait for Guinness confirmation that the spud, which they named Doug, D-U-G, is the largest potato in recorded history, it's just chilling out in their freezer. Time and tide, after a trash can bearing the logo of Myrtle Beach, NC, washed up on a beach in Ireland. Amazing to think it traveled all the way across the Atlantic, said beachcomber Keith McGreal. And it was a good week for neo-Marxism, after a member of Vietnam's Communist Party, who was in the UK for the climate summit, laid a wreath on the London grave of Karl Marx and then dined on a $2,000 a plate gold-wrapped steak at the restaurant of flamboyant chef Nusret Saltbak Golchi. But it was a bad week for Josh Allen, quarterback of the Buffalo Bills, who was sacked by Josh Allen, defensive end for the Jacksonville Jaguars. It was the first quarterback sack by a player with the same name in recorded NFL history. Josh Allen also intercepted a pass by Josh Allen. It was a bad week for cartoon characters after Representative Paul Gosar tweeted out a video clip in which a sword-wielding anime figure with his face slays Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and attacks President Biden. Twitter said the post violated its hateful conduct policy, but left it up because it may be in the public's interest for the tweet to remain accessible. Finally, it was a bad week for calling in sick after North Dakota State Representative Jeff Hoverson missed his own anti-vaccination rally when he got COVID. Hoverson sent word that the disease is real and like a really bad flu. The briefing this week is China's military buildup. China is testing hypersonic missiles and building new nuclear missile silos. What are its goals? What has China been doing? Already in possession of the world's largest fighting force of some 2.2 million troops, China has begun pouring resources into its nuclear arsenal. While it long had about 20 silo-based intercontinental ballistic missiles and some 200 warheads overall as a nuclear deterrent, new satellite images show China has been rapidly building hundreds more silos to potentially fill with nuclear missiles. The Pentagon believes its warheads will double to 400 in the next decade. That's on top of a weapons construction spree that has seen China's Navy exceed that of the U.S. in a number of ships, although many of them are smaller, less potent vessels, while its Air Force has built some 200 advanced J-16 fighter jets and J-20 stealth jets in the past 6 years. Its latest military budget of $209 billion is some 7% higher than the previous years and three times those of number three and number four, India and Russia. To flex its new muscles, China recently sent some 150 planes into Taiwan's air defense zone and encircled Japan with its warships. "They are clearly challenging us regionally," said General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, "and their aspiration is to challenge the United States globally." Why now? The buildup is the work of President Xi Jinping, who set a goal of 2049 for China to be able to fight and win a major war with the U.S. Xi has made restoration of Chinese sovereignty over all its former lands a top priority and a unifying theme for its nation's citizens. Textbooks focus on China's past military humiliations and assert the need for its strength. The country sees itself surrounded in the Pacific by U.S. allies, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and the Philippines. Xi said in 2018 that China cannot lose even one inch of the territory left behind by our ancestors. And since then, China has crushed Hong Kong's autonomy and warned that reunification with Taiwan must be fulfilled by force if necessary. Because the U.S. intends to build up its forces in the Pacific by 2030, some analysts believe China might invade Taiwan in the next 5 years. Right now, the U.S. military is still vastly more powerful than China's, but China is attempting to get ahead in new technologies, such as hypersonic missiles. What are hypersonic missiles? Hypersonic glide vehicles, launched from rockets in orbit, travel more than 3,800 miles per hour at a low trajectory and with maneuverability, so they can potentially evade traditional missile detection and defense. In August, China tested such a nuclear-capable missile, which partially orbited Earth, before landing some 24 miles off target. Some independent arms experts say that hypersonic weapons are not game changers, because in real-world conditions, they probably can be detected as quickly as ICBMs. But the Pentagon worries that China is seeking the capacity for a surprise attack. Milley called the test very close to a Sputnik moment, referring to the 1957 satellite launch that revealed Soviet superiority in space technology. The U.S. is currently pursuing six hypersonic programs across the Air Force, Army, and Navy. What are China's weaknesses? The main criticism of China's military is that while it has invested in flashy hardware, its troop training is weak and the soldiers operating the weapons are inexperienced. Corruption and an outdated command structure have left a very negative impact on the army, says Shi Yang, a Beijing-based Chinese military analyst. Some analysts believe that China's one-child policy, repealed in the past few years, has left it with soldiers reluctant to leave their parents without descendants. China's military has seen almost no combat since 1979, and its various armed forces have little experience working together. That may be why it is actively seeking partnerships. with which countries. China's only formal ally is North Korea, which has nuclear weapons but is desperately poor. But ever since China launched its first joint exercise with Russia in 2003, those countries' two militaries have been cooperating more and more. And in the past few months, that partnership took a leap. In August, some 10,000 Chinese and Russian troops carried out war games in north-central China to test new weapon systems. And in October, they conducted elaborate joint naval exercises involving 10 warships menacing Japan and simulating attacks on U.S. submarines. While Moscow and Beijing have no mutual defense treaty, they do have a common aim of containing the U.S., and a war against both simultaneously would be nightmarish. What are the ramifications? Ever since the U.S. pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2001, an arms race has been effectively underway with Russia and China. Beijing shows no interest in arms control talks, so continued buildups on all sides are likely. And the more weapons, the greater the likelihood of purposeful or inadvertent use. Meanwhile, China's ambition to absorb Taiwan is clear. If China attacks, said retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, the worst case is a conventional war spirals out of control and escalates into a nuclear exchange. The U.S.'s military edge. The U.S. still has by far the world's biggest and most experienced military, as well as the most powerful and advanced nuclear arsenal. Its 1.4 million soldiers have been fighting nearly continuously for the past 20 years, and the various forces have a lot of experience working in close coordination. With an annual defense budget of $733 billion, the U.S. spends more than three times what China does and 12 times as much as Russia. It has 11 aircraft carriers to China's three, and its carrier groups have decades of experience in battle, while China's have none. Still, critics point out that such dominance did not prevent failure in Vietnam and Afghanistan, and until the U.S. repositions its forces from Europe to Asia, China has home field advantage in the Pacific. Whenever the RAND, R-A-N-D, think tank conducts war games for the Pentagon, simulating a conflict in the South China Sea, said analyst David Ochmanek, the U.S. gets its ass handed to it. And we'll read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with two from the U.S. The need for alternatives to Biden-Harris. It is not too soon for Democrats to start worrying about 2024, said Janan Ganesh. Their likely presidential candidates, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, both have significant weaknesses that could lead to a Donald Trump victory. In 2024, Biden will turn 82. His approval ratings are underwater, and after three more years of wear and tear, he might not turn out voters in swing states the way he did in 2020. Might he decide not to run? Vice President Harris, meanwhile, has even worse approval ratings than Biden, and there are whispered qualms among Democrats about her viability as a presidential candidate. If her opponent were Trump, would she win Michigan, Wisconsin, and other swing states that put Biden in office? Remember, during the 2020 Democratic primaries, Harris' performance was so poor, she was forced to drop out very early. Democrats have a long history of deferring to establishment candidates who seem next in line, such as Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and Al Gore, with generally unsatisfactory results. So to beat Trump, the party must be open-minded to nominating someone new who can excite voters and win swing states. Otherwise, Trump might win through sheer Democratic inertia. Why Fox won't muzzle Carlson. Why does Fox News let Tucker Carlson get away with it? Simple, said Brian Rosenwald. Dollars and cents. The cable network's highest-rated host, who has built an audience of millions with anti-vaccine conspiracy theories and white nationalist replacement theory, last week produced a three-part series for Fox's subscription service claiming the January 6th Capitol insurrection was a false flag operation designed to smear Trump supporters. Patriot Purge insisted it was left-wing Antifa activists and FBI undercover agents, not MAGA supporters, who instigated the brutal attacks on Capitol Police. This incendiary claim is nonsense, but Fox's success is tied to luring a narrow slice of viewers who want precisely this style of content. Carlson's bigoted rhetoric draws in more than 3.2 million nightly viewers, which allows Fox to charge cable companies higher fees, bringing in $1.6 billion a year. Fox's only real competition comes from the even more extreme right-wing outlets Newsmax and OAN, which also serve the reddest of meat. So even if he does great damage to American democracy, Fox won't rein Carlson in. Letting him do his thing is good for the bottom line. This column comes from Canada. Quebec is not Europe. It's America. French expats are resettling in Quebec en masse, said Eric Andrew Guy, and some are suffering from culture shock. Over the past 20 years, tens of thousands of French citizens have moved to the French-speaking Canadian province, more than settled here during the entire colonial period. And Greater Montreal now has the largest French-born community outside of Europe. They come for the cultural and economic openness they can't find at home, fleeing France's rigidly hierarchic apprenticeship-based employment structure and its social immobility. While Canadians in the rest of the country see Quebec as a little Europe with its cobblestone streets and bloated bureaucracy, the French see it as almost Californian, a land of swimming pools, friendliness, and jobs. And it quickly becomes apparent to the French arrivals that Quebecers aren't French people who live in America, but rather Americans who speak French. They drink beer more than wine, smoke weed more than cigarettes, and eat dinner at the atrociously early hour of 6 p.m. They tend to socialize with neighbors and family rather than mingling with strangers in cafes and bars like the French. But, one immigrant says, in Quebec, everything is possible. It's still the new world. Moving on to the last word, our feature article, titled this week, Why I'm Not Throwing Out My Stuff. Over the years, boomers have accumulated an astonishing amount of junk, said author Sandy Hingston in Philadelphia Magazine. We should toss it in the trash, but that would mean discarding memories too. Not too long ago, we had guests over to the house. A rare event anymore, even as we all slowly re-enter the world of other people. The occasion was an annual picnic we host for relatives, back on again after a summer skipped because of COVID. And as I welcomed the first arrivals in the living room, I felt compelled to apologize for all the crapola lining my bookcase shelves. I could see my niece and nephew taking in the array of ancient elementary school art projects, nesting dolls, Rubik's cubes, animal carvings, music boxes, and pieces of driftwood with a sort of nervous curiosity. Therefore, Lucy, I explained, referring to my 2-year-old granddaughter. She likes to play with them. They nodded, looking not entirely convinced. I don't blame them. I'm not really a knick-knack kind of girl. I never have been, or at least I never used to be. I do my own dusting and vacuuming, so the idea of having shelves filled with quaint little chocks that have to be removed and put back into place every week was never appealing. For most of my life, I ran a tight memorabilia ship. But then I got old, and somehow I started having more stuff. People died, my dad, uncles, aunts, cousins, and we survivors had to divvy up their treasures. Old family photo albums, china, curios, silverware. Children moved out but somehow neglected to take their belongings with them. Past lives added up. What do you do with the records from the Girl Scout troop you oversaw for a dozen years? The hundreds of children's books you assembled over the decades that turn out to be unwoke now that your kids are finally having kids. And the cookbooks, since you've more or less quit cooking completely, except for those rare occasions like a picnic for relatives, when you have people over and they gape at your trinket-stuffed shelves. One thing you don't do, clearly, is pass things on to your children. Mine are such minimalists that I can't even interest them in really choice items like the family silver. Too ornate, my daughter Marcy said apologetically when I offered it to her. And won't it need to be polished? I have silverware, my son Jake told me, simply stating a fact, that he might on some future occasion require salad forks, soup spoons, and butter knives for 12, all monogrammed with initials that aren't his, was apparently unfathomable. Come to think of it, he's probably right. I'm not alone in realizing my offspring aren't interested in my stuff. All across America, we boomers are stuck with heirlooms and mementos that we can't give away. Generations who grew up to respect speed and convenience, who keep everything they need in their phones, thanks to sigh audibly behind you, in the grocery store line when you pull out your checkbook, aren't likely to clutter up their lives with great-grandma's mahogany drum table or the 1911 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Their homes are sleek and streamlined, pared down, meant for easy movement, and recalibrated lives. They travel light. Part of me admires that. I too was young once. I can remember the allure of thinking I could pivot at any moment and change my surroundings. Head off to Paris or New York City with nothing more than the clothes on my back. The rest of me laments that I can't find homes for these ancestral items, that they and their whole trailing history they hold for me of Christmas mornings and crowded Sunday dinners and barely but fondly remembered elderly relations are fated to wind up on shelves at Goodwill or the table of a yard sale to take up residence, if they're lucky, among other people's families, other people's lives. My husband Doug's mom, who's 89, is going through her second stage of deaccession at the moment. 2 decades ago, she and her late husband moved from their home they built themselves when they were married in the foothills of central Pennsylvania to a much smaller one-story place in an over 55 community. She's pondering moving again now to assisted living. That means Doug and I are going through our second stage of pairing her proffers of taxidermy deer heads and World War II uniforms and lawn ornaments. This time around, I feel her pain. Well, maybe not for the deer heads. But when things have meant a lot to you or someone you loved for a long time, it's hard to consign them to oblivion. My situation is somewhat further complicated by the fact that a lot of my most cherished belongings, the blue and white ceramic elephant occupying the fireplace hearth, the mid-century sideboard in the dining room, the Art Deco candlesticks, have no meaning for anyone. They're just items I picked up at thrift stores back when Marcy and Jake went off to college, and I made, I think, I'm not in therapy, a stab at filling the hole in their absence left with shopping. In other words, I took other people's discarded crap and made it mine. I bought stuff just because I liked it and no longer had to worry the kids and their friends would break it with errant field hockey sticks. It would be a lot to ask anyone to adopt that elephant. even though, and I think this shows admirable restraint, it was part of a pair, and I only bought one. I've been somewhat heartened lately by stories in the press about how thrift store shopping is the original recycling and is gaining new cachet among young consumers drawn to its ecological pluses. This should add another arrow to my quiver of arguments for getting either Marcy or Jake to adopt my wrought iron plant stand when I'm ready to offload it. Why buy new stuff and add to the world's pollution and congestion when I have a house filled to the brim with useful and unique items? I'll even deliver them to you. Of course, this rationale sort of undercuts my refusals of Doug's mom's mounted deer. Meantime, and forgive me if I sound a tad bitter, our home is the repository for all sorts of items the kids feel free to borrow and then return to us, just so they'll never have to buy and store them for themselves. Backpacking equipment, tents, ladders, roof carriers, gardening utensils, power tools, and coolers of every shape and size roost in our basement and garage, like a homeowner's lending library of wonders. At some point shortly after I had kids, my dad announced that he was going to throw everything belonging to me and my siblings the hell out if we didn't come and remove it from his house within 30 days. I think he'd have made good on the threat, too. He wasn't as sentimental as I seem to be. But living through, so far anyway, a pandemic has a way of making you think about death and dying. And thinking about death and dying makes me wonder, what's going to happen to the elephants, the china sets, the lovingly stored away class photos of the kids from preschool through graduation gowns? It's easy enough to say, put it all on eBay. But nobody on eBay wants those old class photos, and I've yet to see anyone's VCR tape collection ring up big bucks on Antiques Roadshow. I could always stuff all this crap into hefty bags and toss it out with the trash. I mean, it is trash, right? Stripped of my memories of when and how it was acquired and used, it's not worth anything. At this point, I'm concerned about not burdening my offspring. And Doug, who's such a workout fanatic that he's sure to outlive me, though if he doesn't, just saying, that will be the sweetest revenge ever, with going through it all. I faced that task after my dad died, which is one reason there's so much memorabilia at my house, including Dad's and Mom's old yearbooks, their wedding and honeymoon albums, and a 20-volume black and gold-bound set of Shakespeare's works, bought early last century, one book at a time, by my grandmother from a door-to-door salesman, faithfully preserved by my dad, and now my responsibility. At some point, somewhere down the line, someone is going to have to say, enough. To hell with it all. I don't think, though, that it can be me. That nag Marie Kondo insists I should strip myself of anything that no longer brings me joy. Life isn't all about joy, though. It's also about wistfulness and grief and pain. There'd be a lot less stuff in my house if I made joy my barometer, but it wouldn't reflect what I've weathered nearly as well. As I drive through America, now that we're more or less free to drive through America again, I marvel at the acres and acres of land devoted to self-storage units. Those attached garage-like edifices stretching across vast vacant fields along highways. According to the most recent statistics I can turn up, the industry is now worth $39.5 billion annually. More than a tenth of American households rent self-storage units at an average cost of just over $89 a month. That's more than $1,000 a year to pay for empty space. The self-storage industry got its start in the 1960s in Texas, where houses don't have basements, and has been burgeoning ever since. What's weird is that the business model has grown and thrived even as the places where we live got bigger, morphing from row houses to split levels to McMansions. In 1973, the average single-family American home took up 1,660 square feet. By 2015, it had grown to 2,687. And still, there isn't room for our stuff. Imagine what my grandmother, parsing out pennies for her handsome set of Shakespeare while feeding and clothing seven kids during the Great Depression, would have made of a house with a dedicated gift-wrapping room. I used to wonder what lay behind all those identical blank doors of all those storage spaces. I imagined frantic consumers avariciously laying in circus-style popcorn poppers from QVC, garish Christmas inflatables, unused pressure cleaners, decades of old tax records, bins and bins of cheap, fast-fashion clothing in sizes ranging, per the latest diet trend and their ability to stick with it, from small through extra large. Now I've softened. I'm more tolerant. I see them crammed instead with layered accumulations that are the natural outgrowth of our nation's prosperity. As generation after generation washed up on America's shores with not much more than pocket change and dove headfirst into capitalism, which is, after all, about acquiring stuff. We may be choosing cremation over burial these days, but self-storage units serve as the new cemeteries. Hilltop monuments to our impoverished pasts, tributes to our heady successes, funerary urns holding all that will be left of us after we're gone. I've come to think of them as shrines. My house is a shrine, too, for as long as I'm here. Still, I remain self-conscious, worried the kids will think I'm tipping over into hoarding. When they're slated to visit, I make a stab at streamlining, gathering up some of the overflow. Before the family picnic, for example, I grabbed a couple of boxes from the basement and filled them with some of the photos and driftwood, a couple of ancient Furbies, Big Mouth Billy Bass, a host of cat toys, a stray stuffed animal or two. In strolled granddaughter Lucy, groggy from her nap in the car on the way here, but beaming when she saw me, knowing she was in for some nonstop spoiling. She glanced around the living room, sharp gaze taking in the still plenty cluttered bookshelves, the novel landline telephone she loves to play with, the plastic baby shark atop the TV set, the F.A.O. Schwartz elephant on the brocade bench. "Where's Bunny?" she demanded, outraged that everything wasn't just as she remembered, picking up instantly not on all that existed, but on the vacancy. "That's my girl. We're not raising some mini Marie Kondo. You're never too young to start staring into the void." This was adapted from a story originally published in Philadelphia Magazine. We'll read one of the obituaries today. The pragmatic psychiatrist who changed therapy. Aaron Beck, 1921 to 2021. In 1959, Aaron Beck made one of the boldest moves of his psychoanalytic career. He removed the couch from his office. Beck had been trained in Freudian analysis, which held that resolving internal conflicts rooted in childhood was the key to easing psychic pain. But Beck saw scant evidence that his patients were helped by lying back and free associating about their pasts. So he moved them to a chair and developed a more pragmatic, collaborative approach focused on training patients to identify ingrained negative beliefs that guide their behaviors. "I'm bound to fail," "nobody loves me," and to modify them with positive thinking. His method, which became known as cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, revolutionized psychotherapy, and has been used to treat millions of people for depression, anxiety, and other disorders. You help patients apply reason and logic to their problems, he said, so they can confront them consciously here and now. Born in Providence, Rhode Island, Beck suffered a near-fatal infection after breaking his arm at age 8, said the Washington Post. During a long convalescence, he became a serious reader and developed an aversion to hospitals and blood. Beck vowed to overcome his phobia through repeated exposure, something he achieved while studying at Yale Medical School. Beck graduated in 1946 with plans to become a neurologist, but a required residency in psychiatry shifted his focus. Entering private practice, he soon began to doubt Freud's theory that depression was the result of anger turned inward, said the Daily Telegraph. Beck's patients craved affection, and their dreams were beset by images of deprivation rather than inner-directed hostility. He wrote that he observed a stark difference between a depressed person's self-image and the objective facts, such as a brilliant physicist who berated himself for being stupid. And when he encouraged his patients to recognize this distorted thinking, many made remarkable progress. Beck's pragmatic view of psychotherapy had its skeptics, said the Associated Press. Some called CBT little more than a morale booster. Beck responded with data from his research, which yielded well over a dozen books and hundreds of articles. Active into his 90s, Beck focused in later years on tailoring CBT for specific conditions, including bipolar disorder, suicidal ideation, and schizophrenia. Its potential applications were endless, he said, because to be human is to deal with problems. This article is from the technology page. Environment. Carbon capture gets real. A new plant in Iceland is proving the concept of scrubbing the air clean and putting carbon dioxide back underground has moved from science fiction to science, said Peter Wilson in the New York Times. Four boxes, each resembling an air conditioner the size of a shipping container, make up the world's first commercial direct air capture, DAC, unit, vacuuming up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The CO2 bonds with a sand-like filtering substance, then is mixed with water and injected hundreds of meters into the ground, where it eventually consolidates as rock. The system, called Orca, was built by Swiss startup Climeworks. The machines can extract 4,000 metric tons of CO2 per year. That's just 3 seconds of humanity's annual carbon emissions, but it is a sign that machine-based solution to the climate crisis is possible. The difficulty with carbon capture was always in what to do with the carbon, said Ivana Kotsova in CNN.com. The amount that needs to be captured vastly exceeds the world's demand for fizzy drinks or carbon-made plastics. Orca claims its system solves the problem with a process that is safe and leak-proof. There is another way to store carbon, said Matt Simon in Wired.com. Planting and conserving trees, which inhale CO2. But even planting a trillion trees won't be enough to offset our emissions. That's why we need technology to provide durable, measurable carbon removal. This is a lovely idea, said Clive Thompson in Mother Jones, but capturing and storing a ton of CO2 costs Climeworks an estimated $500. At that rate, hitting the goal of 10 gigatons a year by mid-century would run $5 trillion a year. The hope is that DAC can scale up, making it cheaper and more efficient. However, in an ironic twist, doing that requires that DAC companies work hand in glove with big oil. Fossil fuel companies are the only ones that have the know-how to build these kinds of facilities at scale and to pipe captured CO2 to locations where it can be permanently sequestered. Direct air capture may not be a silver bullet, said Chris Bryant in Bloomberg.com, but subsidies and grants help solar, wind, power, and electric vehicle manufacturers to innovate and scale up, and they can do the same for DAC. The Biden administration announced last week a carbon negative initiative to help bring down the cost of carbon capture dramatically. Bill Gates and Elon Musk, who don't agree on much, are both writing large checks to support the technology. This is a climate insurance policy that we can't ignore. Here's a Talking Points article. Dormzilla, a billionaire's housing solution. Behold, an architectural horror show, said Carolina Miranda in the Los Angeles Times. Facing a severe shortage of student housing, the University of California, Santa Barbara, has agreed to build a $1.5 billion, 11-story, windowless warehouse designed by billionaire Charles Munger that would stuff 4,500 students into 7-by-10-foot cell-like rooms. Munger, a senior Berkshire Hathaway executive, has no training as an architect, but is donating $200 million to the university on the condition that he design the dorm and have it named for himself. His design provides adjustable LED screens that supposedly mimic the natural light that 94% of the rooms will lack. A host of critics point out that natural light and fresh air are so psychologically vital that they're even staples of basic jail design. And windows and fresh air circulation have become a matter of urgency since COVID-19's emergence. Nonetheless, university leaders call Munger's dorm a transformational project that will be built by 2025. The dorm will look and feel like a self-storage warehouse, said Henry Grabar and Slate.com. But UC Santa Barbara will take it because it's in desperate, desperate need of new housing. Santa Barbara's housing market, like so much of California, is incredibly expensive, with average home prices exceeding $1 million. Local zoning laws ban or severely restrict new apartment construction. As a result, students have been bunking in hotels and even sleeping in their cars. It might be better for students to have no windows than to spend nights at a Marriott or in the backseat of a Hyundai. For student housing, Dormzilla is fine, said M. Nolan Gray in Bloomberg.com. The Spartan single rooms are designed only for sleeping, and Munger's design provides ample communal space to coax students out of their rooms and into the community. Perhaps it's utopian of me, said Aaron Gordon in Vice.com, but I think we can solve housing shortages without stuffing students into windowless cells. Dormzilla's chief detractors are not territorial local homeowners, but architects and engineers armed with research that indicates Munger's design is both unhealthy and unsafe. Imagine a fire or a blackout in a darkened building with 4,500 students trying to flee. Once again, we're seeing proof that in order to solve one crisis, we are often all too willing to create others. Here are a few of the short notes on the Talking Points page. The U.S. may be in for a severe flu season because so few Americans were exposed to influenza last year and may have reduced immunity, the CDC warns. Due to masking and distancing to prevent COVID, only about 2,000 flu cases were reported to the CDC last year, while the previous season saw an estimated 35 million cases. Many countries dramatically understate their greenhouse gas emissions in their reporting to the United Nations. An examination of documents from 196 suggests the gap between reported emissions and actual emissions could be as high as 13.3 billion tons a year, nearly a quarter of the total global emissions. 15 of the 20 California wildfires that destroyed the most homes and other structures have taken place within the past decade, and the state's housing crunch played a key role. Residents priced out of coastal cities moved further inland into cheaper communities in the wildland-urban interface, near flammable forest, where nearly a third of the state's housing units are now located. Nearly 80% of Hispanics in the U.S. identify as lighter-skinned, according to a new Pew Research Center study. Asked to identify their own skin shade, 8 in 10 chose the four lightest options, while 3% chose the four darkest. 62% said darker skin inhibits their ability to succeed in the U.S. On the poll watch, 65% of Americans say the economy is poor, and just 35% say it's good. 47% say they expect the economy to get worse in the next year, while 30% think it will get better. And we'll finish up with a couple of quotes. Author George R.R. Martin says, "People often claim to hunger for truth, but seldom like the taste when it's served up." And finally, from Zora Neale Hurston, quoted in Slate.com, "You've got to go there to know there." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.